This struggle is fundamental because, you know, there's a continuity, there's a profound continuity between the devaluation of migrant domestic work and the devaluation of reproduction, the reproduction of life as a whole. And this affects all women, except those, the happy few, who have capital in their hand and they can exploit other women and other men. Mm-hmm. But we're not talking about those. We're not talking about Hillary Clinton. The fact that Hillary Clinton is defined as a feminist is an abomination. Wow. Yeah.
Let me pick up on the continuities.
Yes.
Because one of the things that I find extraordinary in your work is the way you have been able to draw these huge arcs from, you know, Europe transitioning from feudalism to capitalism and the role of the witch hunts in that process.
Yeah.
To witch hunts that are still going on nowadays,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if everybody's familiar with the studies you did on witch hunts later in more yeah. contemporary settings. But also there, I mean, if we're speaking about the way that the state controls the reproductive capacities yeah. of women, the way that's connected to land,
yes.
and capital, can you tell us more about how come,
yeah.
maybe to formulate simply for everybody, how come witch hunts were so important back then and are still so important right now for
yeah.
you thinking about the control of women's bodies and how that yeah. associates with capitalism?
Yeah, witch hunts were so important, and the witch hunts, I mean, everybody in Switzerland should know, because there were witch hunts in Geneva, and in 2 days also I'm going to go to Glaus, where, you know, we had an execution of a woman, Angoldi, in 1732. So the witch hunts actually lasted from the last part of the 15th century, but then they picked up in numbers and ferocity in the 16th and 17th. These were the two crucial. But then they continue way into the period of the Enlightenment, and very soon they were also exported to the countries that the European conquered and colonized. So you had witch hunts in Brazil, you had witch hunts in Colombia, and you know, basically, when the European went, you know, conquered what we call Latin America, which is nothing Latin about it, you know, Latin America, they basically as soon as the local population, native population, began to effectively struggle against the conquest, then they began to define all native people as devils, mm-hmm. right? And there's an abundant literature and iconography portraying this European conquistador's view, you know, of the native, you know, Caribbean and so on, as devils, you know? But very soon also concentrated on attacks on women in particular. Why it was so important? You know, it was very important because the witch hunts had a very broad scope. You know, the witch hunts, they were fundamental to basically, you know, shape the new disciplinary model, you know, the new form of social discipline, you know, relating, for example, you know, in the case of women, relating what the new task the women had to do. Certainly they serve to break, you know, the resistance that women had built against feudal power, to break the form of solidarity that women had created in their struggle against feudal power, in the struggle, for example, in the heretic movements, so to break their resistance, and to create a woman that would be, in a sense, you know, productive in a capitalist way. For example, you know, a woman whose body, you know, could actually become, and whose procreation could become an economic force. You know, in the earliest phase of its development, capitalism needed more and more bodies, more and more poor people, And so the female body is a machine to produce workers. Not accidentally, a lot of the accusation against so-called witches were accusation of killing children, practicing abortion, you know, controlling, making men impotent. So the element of reproductive work, the element of procreation is very fundamental. Also, capitalism had to discipline sexuality in order to create a, you know, work ethic and an organization, a more intense, you know, organization of work, more intense work of exploitation, and different forms of exploitation, more uniform. You know, in pre-capitalist society, you don't have the 8 hours work day in which you do for 8 hours the same thing, or maybe 10 hours. 8 hours at the machine, 8 hours sitting, you know. You maybe had a little bit of work in the field, and then maybe you changed to some other task, right? So in order to create, right, you had to have a whole disciplining of the body, discipline of the instinctual drive, right? Rechannel passions and desire in a way that they will not be subversive, right? So capitalism, for example, recognized that sexuality can be very subversive. Right, because you know, through desire, through the power of fascination, right, you can enthrall. For example, a woman can make a force a man to do certain things by her magical power, her powers of fascination. So the whole attack, right, the discipline of sexuality immediately translated into a discipline of the bodies of women and into the destruction of the subversive practices and the women who practice them in relation to procreation, in relation to sexuality. Also, capitalism needs to change our relationship to the natural world. Nature becomes a big container of commodity. Nature becomes, you know, the subject of a market. Land is marketed with capitalism. Land goes to the market. And so all the products of land, right? So land, nature, you know, the magical relation that people had with nature, you know, and for example, women were healers. Traditionally, you know, in through the Middle Ages, in the villages, you didn't have the doctor. The doctor comes later with the license given by the state. That's a 16th, 17th century creation, the doctor, the medical profession. And the medical profession is immediately antagonistic to women. They want the disappearance. You know, the midwife becomes a desparecido, a woman who has to either be disciplined, be licensed by the state, or she has to be persecuted. So many of the women who were accused of witchcraft were what, you know, healers, folk healers, in Latin America, curanderas, no? So it's a whole world. And I think when you look at the literature, the social literature, you know, from the Middle Ages to the 18th century, you can actually see the transformation. There is a tremendous transformation that takes place, you know, in the conception of women and in women themselves, right? The witch hunt is the major terrain on the discipline of women, right? And you see that from the aggressive women of the Middle Ages fighting, handing, you know, side to side, standing up to men, being able to go to a local court and accuse a man who had been violent against them, you begin to see the passive woman. Even in the names, you begin to have names like Modest, Prudence. You have all this nice name of a woman who is supposed to be passive, with the head down, not laugh too much. And the witch hunt was fundamental to the breaking of women's solidarity, the solidarity among women. No, the medieval world is a world of collective relation. I mentioned the assemblies. I mentioned that entire villages were involved. So reproductive work was not a work done in the isolation of your home. was not a work that individualized the family, but was work that was often done collectively by women. And I wrote an article in one of my books on the changes in the concept of the word gossip. I don't know what it is in German.
Gerüchte.
The change of the word gossip in the period between 1400 and 1800. In 1400, as you can see from, for example, the mystery plays and other cultural works, like gossip means my woman friend, my woman friend. It means often the woman who was the la matrina, the woman when, you know, you baptize a child, at least in Catholicism, and then they do, yes. But by the 18th century, gossip means what it means today, an idle, malign talk, a talk which has no knowledge. And only women is the talk of women. Only women are said to be gossiping. Mm-hmm. You never hear of men gossiping. You know, men might be lying, might be, but they don't gossip. Gossiping, women chatty, 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 and they say nothing, nothing of value. So this change is really a direct product of the breakdown, of a defeat of women, the disciplining, and also the breakdown of women as a collectivity, right? And it is a mark of the devaluation that women as a social subject undergo, right? That they cannot say anything of importance to each other. They cannot say anything important. Their talk is idle, is empty, is doesn't have any value in it. So that's today, I think for me it was very important to have done the work, you know, in Caliban and the Witch, because I began to recognize some of the story coming, but now it's much more of open domain. But the fact that by the 1980s, in many countries in Africa, in India, Papua New Guinea, we see new chants. Again, once again, women been executed, burned alive. And we're talking about thousands and thousands of women. Some counts put more than 20,000 of women executed in the last 30 years. But the number is certainly much, much higher. And there are many, many factors behind this new persecution. One of them is the question of land. No, many of the execution and the accusation are in areas, are in territories, in countries where land, communal land, is being destroyed. Land is being privatized. No, land is being expropriated by the state for all kinds of extractivist policies. So there is a land scarcity, and the conflicts over land are becoming more and more murderous. And one strategy has been, in many villages, to push women off, you know, the communal land, or to accuse women of witchcraft when they inherit land, or when they have some land, particularly when the women are old, and when, in a sense, they are seen as usurping a means of subsistence or a means of revenue that young people should have. But you don't have this type of situation without a tremendous institutional complicity. Mm. And the institutional complicity comes in a form of foreign companies who have an interest in land privatization, and what you are, in a sense, fomenting these conflicts. Two, the arrival, the spread across the so-called third world of new missionaries evangelical Pentecostal sects originally, and I think today as well, financed by the United States, by right-wing organizations, right-wing agencies in the United States, who have gone hand in hand with the International Monetary Fund, hand in hand with the World Bank, have gone to every part of the world, you know, and carrying a very belligerent concept of Christianity, a concept that said that Satan is out in the world. Mm. And if you're poor, it's not, you know, because of the IMF, it's not because some mining company has come and taken away your land, but if you're poor, this is because, you know, in your neighborhood, there are some people, possibly women, who are conspiring against you. So this creating suspicion, this constantly injecting the devil and devil conspiracy into the day-to-day language of religion has had a very profound impact, you know, in situation, in territory, in society, in which already people were being immiserated. Mm. And immiserated often for reasons that are not clear to the people who are the subject of it. You know, in the old days, let's call it the old days, you know, the old days of the medieval world, you always knew who exploited you. You know, here you were down here, up there was the castle, mm. and you always see the Lord coming with the horse, picking up, very clear who exploits you. No ambiguity. Today, if you are in a peasant community, in an African village, you have no idea. Yeah. 10 years ago, you could sell your cotton and make some money out of it. You know, you could give your cotton to some state agency that would then sell you the cheap price or raise your coffee. You could live by the agricultural work that you were given. And then all of a sudden, you cannot make anything. All of a sudden, you're impoverished. All of a sudden, you're losing your land. Because all the big decisions that are made about your life are made in Chicago, in the big market centers, far away, no more like the Lord in the castle, but far, far away, oceans away from the little village in which you live. Mm-hmm. And so life becomes mysterious. So the idea, and then you see, as a result of structural adjustment, some people in your community are becoming very rich. These are the people who are buying and selling. These are the people who are doing import-export. And some people in your community are becoming very, very poor. Those are losing the land. And what is happening? So the talk of the devil, the suspicion, and this is what is fomenting, you know, witch hunts today. And of course, once you have, you know, that practice, then they can be used in all kinds of ways for revenges. But clearly, in so many societies today across the world, there's also a big generational gap, you know, between a whole new generation of young people, you know, who see the money economy, they see that their future, the possibility of survival is the money economy. And some elderly who may not want to sell the trees, they might not want to sell the last cow, because to them, wealth is not money. Wealth is having some cows. Wealth is having some trees. Wealth is having a piece of land. So there is also a cultural generational conflict, which of course is exploited, because many of these youth, particularly when they are unemployed, they can be easily manipulated not only to become part of armies that assist in the expropriation, but also manipulated to say, she's a witch. She's a witch, I saw her. And rounding her up, put in a place where she will be executed. So this is what, and there's a continuity between the expansion of capitalism in the 16th century and what is happening today.
Yeah.
And why the witch hunts are so important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Thank you also for explaining again to us with this concrete example the impact that the spread of capitalism has to areas that up to a certain point were still isolated from it, and this global expansion of these repressive forces. I am going to close our bit here to allow for maybe one, maybe we manage two questions. Let's see, we've got 10 minutes, it isn't much, but we promised some questions from the audience, and now it's the big competition to see who gets to ask. I saw a hand, I think that the blue hand over there got it first. There's going to be somebody bringing you a microphone. You can ask in German and then Sylvia can put on the headphones, or you can ask in English. Just tell us what you're doing and then we can react accordingly.
So maybe one thing to do is to have maybe several people asking and then maybe some of the questions overlap.
Okay.
Maybe, yeah? And let me get the translation. Unless you're speaking English. In English?
I'm speaking English, hopefully.
Okay, good.
My question was relevant to the joy and joyfulness and struggle. And I was wondering about the idea of theatrically translating your work, so making your work into mime or making your work, your ideas and your theory into something that could be a live, theatrical, interactive experience. And this is something that I'm very interested in. And I was listening to your talk, I've read your books, and I'm very much a fan. But I just wondered if you would welcome this idea, rather than thinking of theory as something that needs to be discussed, but actually having it as something that could be made something playful and interactive and visual.
I'm not sure to translate what I'm saying about joyful militants into something like of a play.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's what you're asking?
That's the question.
Yeah, great idea. Do it. Beautiful. Do it. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. Pass the microphone to the next exciting.
Yeah, and a song. We need songs.
Songs
are very important. I'm a little worried about today's movements because maybe I'm biased. I'm 81 years old. So please forgive me if I'm a little biased, but you know, I come from a big tradition of songs. I come from Italy and we have so many songs, you know, not only from the 60s, but also before, about the war, about everything, about the anarchists leaving to exile, who used to come to Switzerland, by the way. The great exile from Italy was Switzerland. But also, you know, I've lost my thread. Yeah, the songs are from the 60s, yeah? And I'm a little worried that I don't see presently a big production of songs.
And creativity.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, you know, these new movements have to actually be more productive of some joy.
All right, there's still space for a question or two.
Other questions,
Do we have more questions from the audience? There's one here down here.
Please speak up, and you also can make criticism. I don't get offended.
There's definitely one person down here I can see, and there might be one person. Okay, so let's take these two questions together, Sylvia.
Sure.
Otherwise, we'll get under time pressure.
So is it in English or German? English, okay.
So it's going to be one question from up there and one question from down here. Can we start up there and then down here? So we can start with the person up there,
Hello, I'm here on the right side, yes.
Over there.
Ah, good.
Very far away.
I wanted to ask something. First, I want to thank you. Thank you for your brilliant speech. I wanted to ask, we live in a technological society today, and today everything is dependent on resources like lithium and other metals. My question is, how important is it for like people living in industrial countries to connect or organize here with each other? Or how important is it to connect with the workers living in the mines, like the lithium mines, or like a global movement?
Yeah, Let me answer the question. Let me answer the question because it's very, yeah. So, yeah, very important, you know, this question of lithium, right? You know, in Bolivia, for example, there's a big struggle. And, you know, actually people were not happy even, you know, with Morales because he gave so much of, you know, social services and so on, finance, by allowing company to extract lithium. And this is one of the reasons I've been always suspicious when people have spoken about the internet as a common or common building. Because as long as, you know, the production of digital products is dependent on the expropriation of, you know, millions of acres of land on which people used to cultivate crops, and the contamination, you know, of that land, we cannot speak of commons. We cannot say the internet, you know, produces commons, just beside the fact that it is organized by companies while accumulating wealth, beside all of that. But we cannot simply see what internet is doing and not asking how the technologies that are producing it, what is the consequences? How are those technologies produced? Those technologies today are one of the main causes of the destruction of commons across the world. I mean, most of the minerals, for example, come from the Congo, which has been a place of immiseration. The Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, is probably, from all point of view, one of the richest places on Earth as far as minerals are concerned. And yet its population is one of the most immiserated. And this has to do because the Congo is a place of predation, extraction, expropriation, and massacres, all to gain the coltan, the lithium, and all the minerals that are necessary for this booming digital economy. So I think that this is very important. So solidarity, yeah, our solidarity begins. We cannot think. This is, I think, is something very profound that we cannot build our well-being and our prosperity. It's an illusion that we can build our prosperity on the suffering of other people across the world. Because, in fact, you know, all that comes returns. In the States, they say, the chicken are coming home to roost. The chicken are coming home to roost. Today, the maximum exploitation, which is now being exercised, you know, in so much many parts of the world, you know, it's also reverberating in our society. You know, you have a capitalist logic is one. And even though we may not be all exploited with the same intensity, there is an illusion that we can liberate ourselves or build our prosperity on the miseration, you know, of a large part of the world. So I think that the question about technology is very central. And now, you know, we hear about the concern about AI, artificial intelligence, that is going to destroy the world. Well, many communities are already being destroyed. And we have to bring that in our everyday activity. The struggle against that has to be part of our everyday activity.
Sylvia, I'm going to let, I hope it's a short question, and I hope Sylvia can keep it short in her answer.
Of course,
we are running out of time.
Yes.
Let's do the last question.
Yes.
Yes, well, you brought out the sun, so I think this...
yeah, this is amazing, already. This is beautiful.
The most beautiful outcome for today. But my question was about... I'm the one here, down here, from Quattro Castella, which is not far from Parma, where you were born. So what kind of hope do you see for Italy to retrieve some of our legacy of the anarchist and communist movements that your generation, my parents' generations, carried on? So just maybe to conclude.
Yeah, the case of Italy is a very sad case, you know, almost pathetic, I mean, because, you know, you have this woman who is the president